From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Terry Kirkman is my guest this week. A contributor to the Huffington Post, a poet and songwriter, Terry Kirkman is the composer of Cherish, a number one hit for his band, The Association. He's been an addictions counselor for 22 years. Terry Kirkman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
The Association, they were a great group in the 60s. They had a unique sound with wonderful harmonies. What was their origin story?
We formed at Los Angeles. We were originally in a folk group that was the house band at the Troubadour, still a major club in the United States and arguably one of the top two or three most powerful clubs, showcase places in the country, if not the world then. And just by fluke, we ended up being the house band, a group of guys, all guys, and we were called The Men, and we were the first group in the United States working act to be called folk rock.
Before the Birds, you say?
The Birds were actually, when they were the Beefeaters,
yep.
They were rehearsing in the front room of the Troubadour, and we were rehearsing in the big room.
Oh.
And we were the first people in print. Whatever kind of claim that is.
No, that's a major claim, isn't it?
To be called folk rock.
Did you get along well with Doug Weston, the owner of the Troubadour?
Nobody did.
So how did the Men become the Association?
The Men was too big to sustain itself. It was originally a 13-person act, and then it was an 11. And if you're only making a few hundred dollars a week, then you can't pull it off. Even though we had a folk house, a really nice house that we all lived in, or most of the guys lived in, like that. You couldn't do it. And so we, six of us, walked out of the room one day and kind of split the Men down the middle without any animosity. Just, I think we're done here. And within a couple of hours, we had named ourselves the Association. More as a kind of a joke than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it.
I love that album cover of all the Association album covers. I like the one where it's like Stonehenge that says the Association. Were you with the band when they did that one?
Yes.
Yeah, that was a great cover. I remember at least the Association records that I had were on Warner Brothers, but you were originally on a different label.
We were on a label called Valiant that was actually formed around us and two other acts. Shelby Flint, who is a wonderful female singer who has been one of the highest paid studio singers in Los Angeles for all these decades. And I don't remember who the third act was.
Well, how did Valiant Records come to be in your life? How did that happen?
They auditioned for acts, and I just like with the Men, I was almost through the Association. We had a fan club of 20,000 people. And we couldn't get a record deal because nobody could identify the genre of our music, which is really hard to get your head around right now. It was one thing if you were playing straight-ahead folk rock, but Along Comes Mary and Cherish and some of the other songs we were doing on our first album defined categorization as far as the record world was concerned. And if a marketing people can't sell it, if they don't have an outlet for it, they're not going to buy it. So while we had that 20,000 people as a fan club and could guarantee at least 20,000 records, nobody would touch us because there wasn't a radio format set up to play that music yet.
But nevertheless, Valiant signed you, and did you have a hit record right away or not?
We got some noise with our first thing, and which was One Too Many Mornings, the Bob Dylan song.
Uh-huh.
And then we released Along Comes Mary.
Chicken, give me pickled memories. there's the clutch. When big desire is the fire in the eyes of chicks whose sickness is the games they play. And when the masquerade is played, the neighbor folks make jokes at who is most to blame today. And then along comes Mary. And does she want to set him free and let him see reality from where she comes?
Now, I remember seeing you guys on the Smothers Brothers show.
We were quite close with the Smothers Brothers.
Yeah?
Yeah. Sherry Smothers, their sister, lived in the big folk house with all the rest of us. And we were all a part of the same folk club circuit. And the Smothers Brothers were a folk act.
They weren't
a television act. They were a folk act that played the Ice House and the Troubadour and all the rest of the Purple Onion.
We're chatting with Terry Kirkman, and he was one of the founding members of the association. So was that one of your first big television appearances on the Smothers Brothers, or had you guys been on a lot before that?
You know, in writing an article today for HuffPost, I was researching my own group.
Yeah.
And I ran across a blurb that said that we were on every major television show. Smothers Brothers would have been way down the line in terms of our performances. We were the first self-contained rock group ever on the Andy Williams Show, which was the biggest show in the country at the time. I think we were the first self-contained rock group on the Mike Douglas Show. The Red Skelton Show, the Steve Allen Show, all sorts of specials. There's about 40 or 50 major television shows, two Sullivan shows.
Were you surprised when this all happened to you?
Everybody is.
No one is prepared for that.
When it starts to happen at that rate, it's both a blessing and a curse.
What were some of the curse aspects of it?
You're not prepared to handle it. Effects that it has on you psychologically in terms of, do I deserve this? Don't I deserve it? Do I want this much attention? Why can't I be alone? What am I doing on the road 250 days a year? What happened to my private life? Too much, too fast, you know.
Yeah.
It messes as many people up as it does help them.
A few months ago, we had an author on the show. His name is Kent Hartman, and he wrote a book called The Wrecking Crew. It was all about the studio musicians who played on dozens of 60s hits. And his book says that the association didn't play the instruments on their records. Is that true or false?
True.
And how did you guys feel about that? Was that okay?
No, it was in our first album, we had studio musicians and ourselves. Our second album, we played a lot of our own instruments. And once we got into the Warner Brothers thing, Warners wanted our albums done like clockwork. So the playing that we did with Valiant was more on our own terms. And it's hard to remember that our first album was done on 2 4-track machines. Okay? So whatever overdubbing or anything that was even remotely resemble an effect or multiple tracking was a very, very painstaking business of transferring one machine to another, back to the other, trying to get the levels right so they would master well, and it was honest to God rocket science. Then when we got into, when Jerry Esther got fired by Warner Brothers as our third album, and Bones Howe was hired because he'd done the Mamas and the Papas. Mm-hmm. He was actually the engineer, he wasn't the producer. Warner Brothers started having a lot of mandates, and so we were doing complete albums, and I mean complete. Entering it, just sitting down to do the song selection, and then think about arranging them and how the whole album would sound to the very, very end, all in 40 days.
Wow.
And that's 12 songs. And groups now routinely take several months to a year or two or three years to do an album.
Well, even your contemporaries, like, say, the Beatles, took 6 months to make Sgt. Pepper.
Yes. Brian Wilson spent 6 months working on Good Vibrations.
Did you stand by as a group your records, or did you feel that the records were not you?
Both.
Someone who could cherish me as much as I cherish you. Perish is a word that more than a flower. To the hope in my heart each time I realize that I am not gonna be the one to share your dreams. You could cherish as much as I do yours. Oh, I'm beginning to think that man has never found the words that could make you what made me, that have the right amount of life.
You recently wrote in the Huffington Post about Cherish, and I sort of think of Cherish as a slow song, but you said it was too fast.
It was certainly faster than I heard it in my head when I wrote it. And it wasn't a particularly danceable tune, which saddened me. And lots of our tunes did not come out that were intended to be more danceable weren't. I think when you have a democratic group and you have that kind of swept away scheduling hassle, when your life becomes so dense and so filled with being on the road. If you're on the road over 200 days a year, and you're trying to be creative, and that's 200 back to back to back to back to back days. That's no sit down. Very, very rarely more than 3 or 4 days of sit down. You know, like being in a town where you're not hopping on a plane or getting on a bus or driving off someplace. You know, it was we were carbon.
There's someone who could cherish me as much as I cherish you.
By the time I left the group, I was so burnt out, and not from drugs and booze. I was just done.
Just from the grind of performing.
The grind, it, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Almost nobody's marriage survived.
And actually, one of the members of the group did not survive, your bass player.
Brian Cole died in August 4th, 40 years ago.
72. And then you left the group shortly thereafter. Was there a connection?
I left a year and a half after that. The last album he performed on was the last album I recorded with the Associates. I was done. I also wanted to leave the group to do anti-war work, civil rights work that I thought was actually more important than getting up and
making a pop record.
Yeah, making a pop record or wiggling my butt on stage to date night crowds.
Well, I just want to ask about, in terms of wiggling one's butt on stage, there was a concert, it was a famous concert, where Jimi Hendrix lit his guitar on fire and The Who and Janis Joplin really captured international attention. That was the Monterey Pop Festival, and you guys were the opening act at that festival, yes?
We were. It was sort of like being cannon fodder for the for the Viet Cong.
To open up the first Monterey International Pop Festival, we'd like to give you the association.
We were sort of the sound check, lighting check. That's a really frustrating topic for me. It always has been. We had just finished an album. Had we had the album material in our repertoire just 4 weeks later, had we played that just 4 weeks later, I think our experience would have been totally different. We would have performed Requiem for the Masses, and there was no song like that that had ever been done by a pop group. The United States government stomped all over it when it was the B-side to Never My Love.
Mama, mama, forget your pies. Have faith they won't get cold. And turn your eyes to the bloodshot sky. Your flag is flying full. At half mast for the matadors who turn their backs to please the crowd.
And long fell before the bow.
Black and white were the figures that recorded him. Black and white was the newsprint he was mentioned in. Black and white was the question that so bothered him. He never asked, he was taught not to ask what was on his lips as they buried him.
Markets flipped it over. Requiem for the Masses is an anti-war song.
Right.
Two of us begged the group not to do it. We had a little piece of shtick that we would do in date night crowds that was called the Association Machine. It was just totally wrong for the Monterey Pop Festival. But we sang well. We performed well. And kind of got cut out of the mix. But a lot of people, Otis Redding, or Nero, lots of people walked away from that festival really unhappy about what had been represented up front and what they got in return, you know. But the public sees it only in iconic context. All that money that was supposed to be given to legalize marijuana out of the Monterey Pop Festival, I don't think more than a few bucks ever made it to that.
We're talking with Terry Kirkman, and he was one of the founding members of the association. And for the last 22 years, you've been an addictions counselor, and you kind of work with a lot of people who were in show business?
Yes. My last big job was clinical director of the Musicians Assistance Program, MAP, which has now, with the death of the founder of MAP, was absorbed into the Grammy Foundation's Music Cares program. And what we did at MAP, we were completely autonomous. There was about five of us doing this huge amount of work, and our budget was $2 million a year, and we gave 70% of it away to uninsured rank and file musicians, all professional people, or anybody in the music business who was having substance abuse problems.
Well, do you think now that you know, having gone through this experience, that the recreational drug use of the 60s that was popularized by rock and roll groups was misguided?
Yes.
Well, that's a concise answer there.
It's not just rock and roll. I think that when people just started saying, hey, have you taken this? What is it? I don't know, but it really gets you messed up. Oh, here, give it to me, and then I take it. Whether it was PCP, which was really the drug that your grandmother and mother warned you about, there were horrendous drugs that came down the pike. Had it stayed marijuana and wine out of Bota bags, it probably would have been a really nice trip.
Yeah.
Throw a little LSD in there and hope that people don't end up in psychiatric hospitals or jump off of buildings like hundreds and hundreds of people did, thousands of people did. But San Francisco, in all of its just absolutely stunning, wonderful peace and love vibe, which lasted about 2 years, San Francisco and Greenwich Village, which had very much the same feel with pot and booze and a little acid thrown in, all of a sudden became the homicide capitals of the world. Actually, Santa Cruz became the homicide capital of the whole country.
Yes, we had that claim to fame for a while.
But all of a sudden, when methamphetamine hit the streets, violence was like an Arab Spring. It was just stunning. There were 35 murders a month in Golden Gate Park. Walking the streets of Greenwich Village was no longer safe to do at night, particularly not safe at 2 or 3 in the morning when all the speed freaks were starting to come down. The whole world was misguided in that regard. I'm clean and sober 28 years now.
Glad to hear it.
And when I was 32, I had 36 dead friends. So you can't just say, well, whoop-de-doo, it's really cool to be high. Buddy Arnold, the guy who created MAP, the Musicians Assistance Program, he billed himself as the world's oldest living Jewish junkie jazz player. He'd been in every federal prison for, you know, writing bad script and selling drugs and stealing, stuff to get high. Buddy's motto was, don't buy the lie, it ain't hip to die. When I was 32 years old, I had 36 dead friends.
Yeah.
If you read the Phil Oakes poem, my last posting on HuffPost, it's me with Phil Oakes and Timmy Harden, arguably two of the best singer-songwriters ever to live ever. And they're both dead.
Yeah.
You know, everybody died.
Yeah.
And by the time I got sober in my mid-40s, I didn't want to know how many people were dead. I had friends who were dying as regularly as I do now in the newspaper, seeing people my age. I'm 72. And you get in your 70s, you start to automatically have a lot of acquaintances who are dying, you know?
Yeah.
But in your 20s. At the same rate when I was in my 30s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a little bit about politics before we go, because you were a part of the protest movements of the 60s and so forth. And you know, nowadays people are complaining a lot about the political situation. That's never been worse. But what do you think?
I think it's always been bad. I don't think that it's as bad as it is now. I don't know. During the 60s, we became so instantly polarized and people got so afraid about what was happening with the music and all of a sudden the demands for desegregation and all of a sudden, whoa, who are all these gay and lesbian people and what's going on? You know, that scared people, I think in some ways for that the fear thing was logical, but this I really honest to God think that we really are deeply immersed into plain and simple nuts and bolts fascism. I think that we're owned. I think there's no separation between corporate America and the government. There. Am I still on the air?
You are, absolutely. Our guest has been Terry Kirkman, and you can read his posts, and they're excellent. His blog, I guess you'd call it, on the Huffington Post. And he's a poet, he's a songwriter, he's an author, and he was one of the founding members of the association. Terry Kirkman, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf. We enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can check out our podcast page at www.fromthebookshelf.com. Find us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. I want to thank my guest, one of the founding members of the association, Terry Kirkman. I also want to thank Barry Levitin for his assistance this week. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.